Secretary Clinton, you're not in the White House yet.
Not yet.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is your broadcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast and 106.7 FM KSO in Cottage Grove. Out in Pennsylvania on 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster. Out in Hawaii on 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui. Up in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. And of course, coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Nashville, many other fine affiliates, and of course, Radio Sputnik 5 days a week. You can run, but you can't hide. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you for joining us once again as we try to make sense of it all, as they say on the theme song there. Well, the two remaining 2016 Democratic presidential candidates, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, faced off once again on Thursday night at a debate, this time in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It was their first debate since Bernie Sanders' decisive, even record-breaking, 22-point victory over Hillary Clinton at the New Hampshire primary on Tuesday. The debate on Thursday night was sponsored and produced by PBS. It was also simulcast on CNN, moderated by the PBS NewsHour's Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff. And it marked the first time that there was an all-female duo moderating a Democratic debate. Also, as Hillary Clinton pointed out, it was the first time that women actually outnumbered men on a presidential debate stage. That was kind of cool. Sanders and Clinton both slugged it out on a number of topics in advance of the race that is now broadening out to the Nevada caucuses in a week or so. Then it heads down to South Carolina a week later, and then Super Tuesday, where more than a dozen states will hold caucuses and primaries on March 1. God save us all. There has been very little polling in either Nevada or South Carolina up until now, with much of the media having been focused for months on Iowa and New Hampshire, and with the difficulty of polling for Nevada's caucuses in particular. But there is a new poll out today now. The first one of the year in Nevada, showing that after Clinton had been believed to have a decisive advantage in Nevada and South Carolina, both states with a more diverse electorate than Iowa or New Hampshire, well, according to this new poll, at least the pair are now said to be virtually tied in Nevada. According to that first poll out this year in the state, that's a Washington Free Beacon Target Point poll. It was released on Friday, showing both of the candidates tied at 45% now in Nevada. But again, that's just one poll at this point. It well could be an outlier. We won't know until there's more polls, more data available. And again, it could reflect the difficulty of polling Nevada's caucus system, to be frank. Previous polls had shown Clinton with a double-digit lead there, but everything may well be changing and changing quickly following the New Hampshire primary, where Sanders just dominated every single demographic just about up in the Granite State, suggesting to some, at least, that he may be much more electable than national media, at least, had previously regarded him to be. Here to make sense of Thursday night's Democratic debate up in Wisconsin, I'm happy, very happy to welcome back longtime journalist, former CNN and current TV reporter, and the first ever internet correspondent on cable news, Jackie Schechner, who also worked in D.C. as the National Communications Director for Healthcare for America Now, the nation's largest healthcare reform campaign. And she also happened to be in Paris not long ago working on Al Gore's climate reality project when the Paris terror attacks broke out. Jackie Schechner, welcome back to the broadcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be a part of it.
Great to have you here as ever. Also joining us, David Dayan, our old friend, financial reporter and contributing columnist at Salon, Fiscal Times, New Republic, Washington Post, The Intercept, American Prospect, and just about everywhere else. Hey, David, welcome back to the broadcast as well, sir.
Pleasure to be with you.
All right. Well, we will get into a lot of the specific moments in the debate shortly, but I want to start with a few broader questions. Oh, and yes, okay.
I'm here too.
There's Desi Doyen, our producer. Hi, Desi.
Hi. I'm here too.
I'll welcome you to the broadcast as well.
Well, thanks.
It's the least I can
do.
Nice
of you.
All right. Now, I want to get into the specifics in a moment, but let's go to some of these broader questions first. Jackie, last night you tweeted, if you put a Dem debate and GOP debate side by side, you would think they were competitions for leaderships of two completely different countries. You're right, actually. That was a great point. It was very true. But that said, the first debate since Sanders' 22-point win in New Hampshire, one might have expected more fireworks, I think, than we saw. Tell me if I'm wrong here, but I thought it was a bit more subdued than previous debates. And is that because both of them are exhausted by now? Is it because it was on PBS? Or am I just totally wrong about it? And it was me who was tired last night, not them.
No, I think it's a combination of it. First of all, they both seem tired. Sanders, I think, a little more so than Clinton. We could hear him coughing in the background while she was speaking a few times.
Mm-hmm.
I actually tweeted after that, somebody get him a lozenge, because I think that he, and we heard it in his acceptance speech in New Hampshire, too. Like, he's tired, and I think it would suit them both to have a couple of days off. And I also think that they're both trying very hard, or at least I feel like he is, to keep the rhetoric civil. I think that they are seeing what's going on the Republican side, and they don't want to go anywhere near it. And so the feeling I get, at least, is that they're trying to counter each other and be respectful while doing it. And there are times when it gets a little heated, because that's the nature of sharing your thoughts and opinions in that format.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that they're making a conscious effort not to get to where the Republican field is and to keep it above that fray. I think that's what part of what sets them apart and makes me very, very proud to be on the Democratic side.
David Dayan, last week, Lloyd Blankfein, CEO, I think it was last week, CEO of Goldman Sachs, one of the largest investment banks in the world, said on CNBC that the Sanders campaign, quote, represents, quote, a dangerous moment, not just for Wall Street, not just for the people who are particularly targeted, but for anybody who is a little bit out of line, unquote. Does that suggest that Wall Street is actually really worried at this point about a Sanders victory over Clinton? Are the bankers really as worried about a Sanders presidency or even a Sanders moment as that quote would suggest? Or am I reading too much into that, David?
I think there is, looking at this campaign, like everybody else, and seeing something that I'm sure they take as fairly improbable, that someone who spends most of his campaign bashing the industry that they work in is getting a lot of positive reception to that message. And whether Sanders wins or not, it can't help but move the country in a certain direction. You even see this with Secretary Clinton's mm-hmm. rhetoric about Wall Street, saying that she has a tougher plan, that no bank should be too big to fail, and that no executive should be too big to jail. I mean, she is adopting a lot of this rhetoric, and it's kind of boxing her in, where in a hypothetical Clinton administration, that the antennae of the Democratic base is going to be very attuned to that. So whether or not Sanders wins, his campaign is proving what a good message it is to look upon the people who perpetrated the largest recession since the Great Depression, and point to them as a malign force in our economy. So, you know, I think Blankfein's justified. It is dangerous. It's dangerous to him.
To him.
And he's a guy that thinks what's good for Goldman Sachs is good for America.
But even if all of Sanders' programs were put forward, you know, reform of the tax system, getting rid of the offshore havens, tax havens and so forth, all of the speculation tax to fund his college tuition plan, even if all of that happened, do these bankers, I mean, these bankers would still be multimillionaires and billionaires. This wouldn't actually hurt them, would it? It would just make them, you know, sort of less obscene in their earnings. Am I right?
Well, I mean, I'm not a banker. I mean, I don't know what,
yes,
what
you
they're
are
hurt by if they're, you know, if their bank account says 50 million instead of 200 million. I would say that they probably think that's a great deal of hurt. Even though the comparison to an ordinary plumber or pipe fitter would be, you know, kind of ludicrous. But, yes, I mean, the truth is that Sanders is, his program is not socialism in the sense of taking control of the means of production. It's a democratic socialism that is still has a large role for capitalism and capitalist success. Just one in which the fruits of capitalism are more broadly shared.
Let me jump in quickly, if I can, just
sure.
on this, because there's something that I think is important to note, is that Bernie Sanders' message definitely is pushing Secretary Clinton farther to the left, which is what he's intending to do.
Mm-hmm.
But this messaging, this anti-Wall Street messaging, is not all that different than what President Obama ran on. And I think the problem that we're running into in general is that this is very good messaging for the electorate, especially for progressives. I fear that once Secretary Clinton gets elected, if she does, that not all that much is going to happen. And I think that that's where progressives or Democrats who really like Sanders' message draw this distinction between the two, because the fear is, yes, like Sanders said last night, Wall Street doesn't just throw money at Secretary Clinton because it's got money to spare. It's expecting something in return. And the idea being that the rhetoric and the campaign messaging may be on point right now, but frankly, what holds her accountable when she's elected?
Well,
and if it's not her messaging from the if it's not her messaging from the beginning, but it's messaging that she adopted to get elected,
right?
What then keeps her in line once she holds office?
Well, one thing I would say in response to that, there's a very notable coalition that actually put out a platform just in the last 24 hours, and it's about presidential appointments and the importance of presidential appointments, and the biggest thing that both a Clinton administration can do and that the U.S. Senate can check her on is her appointments to key positions like the Treasury Secretary or the Attorney General or the head of the SEC. And the idea all along, kind of, for a subset of the Progressive Coalition, which includes Elizabeth Warren, this has been her main point throughout this entire primary process, is that personnel is policy. That if you have a set of people in the room that are more inclined to think about the American homeowner than the balance sheets of the banks, then you get a different outcome in a moment of crisis, or even in just a normal, regular moment. So the way that the secretary can be held to account is by looking at who she chooses to staff those very key regulatory positions that interpret and enforce the laws on the books that have a great deal of power and you know, go a long way into assessing, you know, what actually, you know, whether these promises are kept.
And that's something, David, that I know you have written about in regard to Elizabeth Warren over the years and her successes in actually blocking certain appointments to certain boards and so forth.
And she has a lot of people who follow her and will take action on her behalf. And she has been successful in stopping some appointments that she perceived as being too close to Wall Street under the Obama administration.
And
Clinton has to know she'll do that again.
I was going to say, and so a case could be made here that even if everything does go south for Bernie Sanders at this point, Hillary Clinton is sort of locking herself in
Science shows that most presidents try to keep their campaign promises when they get into office. And so making these promises at the outset, you know, getting Hillary Clinton on the record to say, I'm not going to cut Social Security, that has value.
It does. And even when it comes in a tweet, perhaps especially when it comes in a tweet, because everybody sees it at once. Yeah, as Hillary Clinton did last week, once the Sanders campaign pushed her to make that position that I will not cut Social Security. Okay, we got to get to a break shortly, but one more thought I want to get in before we do, and then we'll get into the meat of the debate. But PBS... Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff brought up, I think by my count, at least three different questions that may have been, you know, handed to them by the Republican Party specifically about the size of government, how large it should be, as if, you know, government, I think they said at one point, is 21% of GDP. How large would you make it? My first question, I guess, here is, personally, I feel like who cares? If you add $1 trillion to the GDP, putting people to work, it doesn't seem like it matters whether it comes from government or whether it comes from the private sector, that this is a Republican meme. But maybe I am wrong. David Dane, we talked about it, I think, a little bit last time you were on. But does it matter where money comes from if people are put to work and then that money subsequently makes its way into the economy? Is this a success for Republicans just because we talk this way about the size of government? Not even regulations and so forth, but just how much money they spend.
As if that's a goal in and of itself.
A smaller government. Right.
I do think it's a success for the right in terms of their messaging. I'll give you an illustrative example. So Michael Moore has this movie that releases today called Where to Invade Next.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the points he makes in that movie is reframing the idea of taxes. So if you look at the tax, because he goes to all these countries in Europe, and he looks at some of their good ideas, and he says that he wants to reclaim them for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, he says, they do pay higher taxes in a place like Denmark, Norway, in Scandinavia. They pay higher taxes. However, what that doesn't take into account is child care expenses that American parents pay in the United States, or health care premiums, or all of these other things. They're not taxes. But if the government is giving them to you in substitution for the taxes that you're paying, it's effectively the same thing, right? And so you can talk about the size of government, but if the incorporated in that size of government are a host of goods and services that you then do not have to worry about as part of your private income,
mm-hmm.
then it's a completely different scenario. You have to make the right comparison.
And that goes to Bernie's point and the debate they have been having over health care. We're going to talk about that after this break. But let me very quickly, Jackie, let me get a thought, because you were at CNN for a while. Tell me about the way that the media sort of adopt these talking points, whether they make sense or not, because, you know, the Republicans are saying this because the Republicans are demanding that for some reason government be smaller. Corporate media, and in this case, PBS of all outlets, feel they need to adopt those political memes. Where does that come from? And did you see that during your time at CNN?
Yeah, it's a strange line of questioning, and I would just say that somewhere along the way, the idea of government as the enemy became the problem, because government in other countries is seen as the tool of the people and is seen as an entity for good. And somewhere along the way, I mean, I think it's comical, people run for office who hate government.
Right.
So it's a tremendous
irony.
Somewhere
along the way, by the way, we can pinpoint where along the way it happened. Well, it's Ronald Reagan saying that the most dangerous words in the English language or I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah, and that has been a, what are we at now, 35-year, almost, 35-year con, I believe, that Reagan put over on the American people, and that it seems like the media, both the corporate media and, unfortunately, PBS, which I guess really is now corporate media as well, seem to have adopted.
Yeah, it was a strange line of questioning. I don't understand why the size of government was even mentioned. It should be more about efficiency in government or how money's spent or getting the waste and fraud out of these particular places where money is being misspent. But size is such an odd, it's such an odd way to frame it.
And
I don't really know where it came from.
And not even once, but literally three different times. I couldn't believe when they came back from their first commercial, and yes, they now have commercials, it seems, on PBS, came back and brought it up again.
Yeah, so they had time for three different questions on the size of government, and of course, you know, my wheelhouse, not a moment to ask about climate change or energy.
Oh, you
at
and you,
all.
You and you single issue
that whole existential thing. Forget about that.
You single issue voters. We'll get into that single issue vote in a few minutes here. I got to take a quick break. I'm speaking with, who am I speaking with? Jackie Schechner and David Day. And
we've made an impression.
You have fine journalists both, and even Desi Doyen.
See? Me too.
I remembered you this time. All right, a quick break, and we are back with much more of our post-Democratic debate coverage right here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned.
Today, Senator Sanders said that President Obama failed the presidential leadership test. And this is not the first time that he has criticized President Obama. In the past, he's called him weak. He's called him a disappointment. He wrote a foreword for a book that basically argued voters should have buyer's remorse when it comes to President Obama's leadership and legacy.
The kind of criticism that we've heard from Senator Sanders about our president, I expect from Republicans. I do not expect from someone running for the Democratic nomination to succeed President
Obama. Madam Secretary, that is a low blow.
Oh, I was low, Gabriel, low. Mighty low, Gabriel, low.
Yep.
But now since I've seen the light, I'm good by day and I'm good by night. So blow, Gabriel, blow.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Post-Democratic debate coverage from Thursday night's debate up in Wisconsin with my guests today, Jackie Schechner and David Dayen, financial reporter David Dayen, and Jackie Schechner, healthcare journalist, activist. I think that's the right way to call you, Jackie. You had a tweet. Well, actually, let me play a little bit more because that was sort of unfair in that we ended it there with Sanders decrying the low blow from Hillary Clinton. Let me play his response in full, and then I'll get your thoughts, Jackie and David, on this one.
Madam Secretary, that is a low blow. Last I heard, we lived in a democratic society. Last I heard, a United States senator had the right to disagree with a president, including a president who has done such an extraordinary job. So I have voiced criticisms. You're right, maybe you haven't. I have. But I think to suggest that I have voiced criticism, this blurb that you talk about, you know what the blurb said? Blurb said that the next president of the United States has got to be aggressive in bringing people in to the political process. That's what I said. That is what I believe.
Calling the president weak, calling him a disappointment, calling several times that he should have a primary opponent when he ran for re-election in 2012. You know, I think that goes further than saying we have our disagreements. As a senator, yes, I was a senator. I understand we can disagree on the path forward. But those kinds of personal assessments and charges are ones that I find particularly troubling.
Senator, you may respond to that, but it's time now for closing statements, and you can use your time for closing statements to do that.
One of us ran against Barack Obama. I was not that candidate.
Well, meow. Jackie and David, I want to get both of your thoughts on that. She has used this attack before. She is wrapping herself in Obama, so to speak. I think unfairly referencing, I was going to say unfairly referencing that blurb that that Bernie Sanders included on Bill Press's book, although that book is about Obama being a disappointment to progressives. And in fact, Bernie Sanders did talk about the possibility of a primary challenge to Obama back in 2012. So is that a fair line of criticism from Hillary Clinton, as you see it, Jackie?
I have absolutely no problem with Bernie Sanders challenging President Obama. This doesn't bother me one bit. And I think that going after him for it is a low blow and unnecessary. Because, frankly, I mean, let's be totally honest, while President Obama has done some good stuff, he is a disappointment to progressives. He was a disappointment. I worked on health care reform. That was my single issue. Mm-hmm. He made a lot of promises during the campaign, and when we went into the fight for healthcare reform, he didn't follow through on those promises. I can think in particular when we lost the public option. He spent 80% of his advertising in October of 2008 talking about what kind of system we were going to have. And on one side was single payer, the other side was private insurance, and he argued that we were going to have something in the middle that was going to be a mix that included a public option. And when that became difficult, he dropped it. And I think that as somebody who really not only drank the Kool-Aid, but frankly mixed the Kool-Aid and passed it out, I was really disappointed in the way that he negotiated or didn't negotiate with Republicans and some blue dog Democrats.
Okay, while it's fair for anyone, Bernie Sanders in this case, to criticize the president, are you saying it's also fair for her to call him out on that? And is it therefore effective? He was critical of the president. Is that effective? Actually, I guess, does that work for her or does that work better for Bernie? Who does that end up redounding to, Jackie?
Well, I think that it's a non-factor. I mean, in terms of, I don't think it's a nice thing for her to do to attack him and say that he attacked the president. What he's trying to do, I think, is speak to his base, which are progressives who really want somebody who believes in being progressive. And I think there's some part of the party that believes that President Obama was never really that progressive and that some people just projected that onto him. Others say he sold himself as a progressive and he wasn't. So it really depends on which camp you buy into on that. But I don't have a problem with it. I mean, we look on the Republican side and you've got the whole Tea Party segment that actually drove the Republican Party so far to the right mm-hmm. that they don't even know where they stand anymore. So why is it a bad thing for people on the left to say we would like our president to be more of a Democrat in the way we see it, more of a left Democrat.
David Dayan, does that end up, and Jackie, I think, makes a very, very good point. That said, among the Democratic electorate, or at least among the Democratic primary electorate, does her argument work in her favor or in Bernie Sanders' favor, as Jackie suggests?
I think we can separate it out, and we can talk about the way that Jackie said, that it's obviously okay to criticize a sitting president and have a difference of opinion. You don't have to line up behind them like automatons. But we can separate that out and say politically this is a good move for Hillary Clinton. Not only is Barack Obama enjoying among Democrats probably an 80% approval rating, what we know is that in South Carolina he has closer to a 90% approval rating. And so, we've seen Hillary Clinton using Barack Obama as a human shield. And she's doing it because the polling tells her that makes a lot of sense. And that, generally the primary electorate in the upcoming states thinks that Obama has done an excellent job and that a candidate for the Democratic nomination coming in with critiques of the president is not going to have a great impression on that primary electorate.
And I think
so that's just the sad reality of this. I don't have to like it to recognize its effectiveness.
That it's astute.
But doesn't it also have to do with race? I mean, isn't there also a very large African-American population? Right. And so the idea is that she is going to say that he's criticizing the black president because he's from Vermont, it's a white state. Like, he's not the least bit racist, but his economic message will resonate with an African-American, an impoverished African-American population.
Right.
And so in order to negate that, she's wrapping herself in the first black president.
And we should say that South Carolina's primary electorate on the Democratic side is, might even be majority.
Yeah, I think it's 55% African American. And as long as you bring it up, as long as Jackie played the race card,
for the woman to play the race card.
Yeah, way to go, Jackie. Well, as long as you brought this up, and I'll open this up to all three of you if anybody has can help me out here. I don't understand the supposed huge African-American support for Hillary Clinton. I didn't understand it for Bill Clinton. I didn't understand when they called him the first black president. You know, it seems to me between welfare reform and, criminal
sentencing,
criminal sentencing. Right. I don't understand why the black community seems to identify so much more with Hillary Clinton than Bernie Sanders, I guess. But is this just a sort of a remnant, a legacy of Democratic machine politics? She has been around so long. Tell me why she's so popular. Yeah, please do.
One thing is that the 1990s, and particularly the late 1990s, was the last time that wages rose broadly in this country. And they rose for all sectors. They did not just rise for the rich. Because we had close to full employment, jobs were very plentiful at all levels of the economy, and that includes the African-American community, communities of poverty. One reason that they got away with welfare reform is because in the late 90s, less people were in the position to require significant public assistance. And so there is an era of good feeling kind of mentality to the late 1990s in terms of where the economy was. Now, lot of that was built on a castle made of sand because we ended up with the dot-com bubble that burst the stock market bubble in the beginning of 2000s. And which led to the housing bubble, which then burst. So a lot of this was sort of based on asset bubbles.
Yeah, but
however, it's undeniable that the rising tide did lift all boats in the late 1990s.
Yes, it did, David. But if that is the case, wouldn't that also redound to support for her from low-income voters across the board, not just the African-American communities, but, well, not just low, but low and middle-income voters across the board?
Well, I just want to say, I think that the difference here, at least in this current campaign, including the 1990s good feeling, but that in this campaign, Bernie Sanders talks about mostly the economic triggers, the economic factors and trends that are at work keeping the middle class and the lower income people down, whereas Hillary Clinton talks about rights. She doesn't talk about the economic underlying reason why we have all of these issues that we're working with and grappling with now. She talks about, I want to expand LGBT rights. I want to expand women's rights, fight sexism, fight the, mandatory sentencing and criminal racial disparity and criminal sentencing. So I think because she focuses on rights as what she wants to expand versus Bernie Sanders talking about, I want to change the economic structure underneath, I think that speaks more to those communities.
Let me add one more thing, and that is that in my experience, and this doesn't necessarily just come from me, but it comes from, African-American writers and thinkers that I know, is that the African-American electorate for the Democrats is extremely loyal. And one reason that it's extremely loyal is that there is an innate fear that if the other party comes into power, that's going to, the things that would happen would be more devastating for the African-American community than they would be for well-off white liberals, necessarily, just to use that terminology.
So they
care about electability more. That's my point.
Well,
they care about this electability argument much more, and it's loyal machine politics.
Well, if it's about electability, then that may change the view, the support that Hillary and Bernie get may change as Sanders becomes more electable.
Right. Remember
appearing.
That in 2008, they had to be, the African-American community was not on board with Barack Obama originally.
That's
because they had to be convinced that he had what it took to take it all the way and win the presidency.
Okay, let me get into some specific issues here. And Jackie, you may have a thought on all of that, but I'll allow you to put it into your response to health care as if this was a debate. This is... once again, they went back to fight over Bernie's call for a single-payer Medicare for All plan. Here is a bit of that conversation.
Secretary Clinton has been going around the country saying Bernie Sanders wants to dismantle the Affordable Care Act. We're not going to dismantle anything. In my view, health care is a right of all people, not a privilege, and I will fight for that.
Well, I can only say that we both share the goal of universal health care coverage. I am a staunch supporter of President Obama's principal accomplishment, namely the Affordable Care Act. I know how hard it was to get that done. And it is difficult to, in any way, argue with the goal that we both share, but I think the American people deserve to know specifically how this would work. If it's Medicare for all, then you no longer have the Affordable Care Act, because the Affordable Care Act, as you know very well, is based on the insurance system, based on exchanges, based on a subsidy system. So if you're having Medicare for all, single payer, you need to level with people about what they will have at the end of the process you are proposing. And based on every analysis that I can find by people who are sympathetic to the goal, the numbers don't add up.
Okay, we'll talk about the numbers in a second, but Jackie Schechner, I know that you worked as hard and as long as really anybody on this as National Communications Director at Healthcare for America. Now, at the time that they were trying to get the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare passed, I would think, I find it incredibly dishonest, frankly, to frame this whole thing as Sanders wanting to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, when in fact he wants to replace it with a single-payer system, a Medicare for All system. But you worked very hard to get the ACA passed. I would think you would be somewhat sympathetic, at least, to the argument that Hillary is making, you know, that it was just way too difficult to get that passed as far as suddenly now going in a different direction with single-payer Medicare for All. What are your thoughts on this? And is it just too difficult to do right now? Is Hillary right? We should move on to some other issues for the time being, at least?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts on this. One, practicality is not inspirational. And I think that's part of why she's not resonating with people that she should be resonating with. Because she's not wrong. It's a heavy lift. It will continue to be a heavy lift. But that's not what the electorate wants to hear. And I think that in and of itself, while it's correct that there's only so much that we can do, I don't think that that's a strong political message when you're running for office. The second part is that I don't think either one of them is going to get anything done with regard to health care in the immediate future. I just think we're exhausted. I think it was an incredibly heavy lift. We're all a little bit burnt out from it. I think the Affordable Care Act did a lot of really good things, and it opened the door to make changes down the line. But not until we hit an extraordinary tipping point are we going to be ready to launch back into that fight again. And believe me, if I think that we are, I'll be on the front lines of it.
Well, but I don't think we're there yet. But Bernie Sanders is building a lot of his campaign around the idea of health care for all, health care as a right. And I think that's where actually Desi Doyen, you're wrong about Hillary calling for rights. Bernie's been, you know, calling for rights, health care rights.
But he frames it as an economic argument rather than civil rights, which is what I was talking about, the difference about what resonates with a community.
Okay. Well, fair enough.
Sure, and he brings it up. Look, he brings it up all the time, and it is one component of where they disagree or they differ, because there's not all that much difference between them as far as getting a Democrat into office and continuing down this path that we're on that President Obama has started. But let's be frank about how our political system works for a moment. Neither one of them is going to get anything past Congress, unless we get a Democratic Congress, unless we get more Democrats into office in the House and the Senate. Neither one of them is going to get anything
through. And, of course, that's the argument that Bernie is making, that elect me because I will get out more people. You will end up with more Democrats in the House and Senate if I run. And, of course, Hillary is making
We're looking at 4 more years of Benghazi, frankly. I mean, we're looking at four more years of illegal email servers. I mean, the GOP hates her as much as they hate Obama. So I do think, in terms of what he's saying, it is more inspirational. It definitely hits a nerve with progressives who say that we should have gone for single payer the first time around, which was not a practical reality. And I had this discussion with many single payer advocates when we first started with HCAN, that you weren't going to, they said, why not go to the negotiating table with single payer and then find a middle? And I said, there wouldn't have been any table had we started with single payer. Mm. People are scared. They don't want to lose the status quo. I think the longer we sit and stew in the status quo of insurance company abuse and scam, the closer we'll get to the opportunity to figure out how to push them out of our healthcare system. But they're too strong. They're too powerful. They make too much money. They own too much of the medical industrial complex.
They are not unseated ever until you take them on, and you take them on over a long period of time. And to Bernie's credit, whether it succeeds or not, you need to keep talking about it. You need to keep saying it. You need to normalize the idea that, you know what, healthcare is a right, and private insurers have no business, you know, making money from our illness, basically, because they don't really provide anything. And let me just also note, since you referenced the quote unquote illegal server, you were being sarcastic. Right now, we have no evidence that there was an illegal email server.
Yeah,
and I'm only saying,
I
just want to clear that up because, you know, people may hear that. That is what Republicans are repeating. And I know you didn't mean it that way. You were being sarcastic. Let me ask David very quickly before we get to free college here. David, they say, we talked about this before, but let's just very quickly. She says his numbers don't add up. He's talking about a Wall Street. Where does his money come from for the single payer for his Medicare for All system? Where does it come from? And do those numbers
tax through part of it through the payroll tax, and part of it through graduations of the income tax. Most of the income tax stuff falls on the wealthy, but most the payroll tax falls on everybody.
So is when she says that progressive economists have said his numbers don't add up for single payer, is she right about that?
She's talking about somebody very specific, and the name is escaping me right now, but that person showed that she's basically talking about the amount that Sanders assumes will be saved by moving to a single payer system. And that individual who ran through a report of it said, you won't be able to save as much money as you think, and therefore your taxes, because Sanders was fairly vague on the design of the program, but very specific about the taxes that he would assess. And basically what this guy was saying is that you're not going to save as much out of the system. You're not going to wring as much efficiency out of the system as you think, and your taxes are going to have to go up, maybe double where you are now. So that's the argument that they're having.
So is it a legitimate criticism, or
is sympathetic to the idea of universal health care? I wish that we would get a little more specific about who we're talking about when we're talking about the people left behind under Obamacare. You know, Senator Sanders said that 29 million people today don't have health care. Well, who is he talking about? A large percentage is undocumented immigrants who are not allowed even to buy into the exchanges with their own money. So a lot of them are put on the sidelines. So is that really about health care, or is that about the immigration system? Number two is the either the people who fall into sort of this trap in states that haven't expanded Medicaid and they're too poor to get subsidies on the exchanges, but too rich, quote-unquote, to get Medicaid from their state. That's a gap, and you have to figure out how to deal with that. And one way is to really run a campaign to get states to accept the Medicaid expansion.
Well, and that's because Republicans were able to have that victory in the Supreme,
Supreme Court
that allowed them to decide.
So is that a health care question, or is that a Supreme Court question? Is that a state organizing question? And then the third bucket is people for whom health insurance, even with the subsidies on the exchange, is actually too expensive.
And
they hit an affordability hardship where they don't have to abide by the mandate. And that's really a question of how much in subsidies we have.
Let me do this, David, because I got to do a break shortly, but let me run this very quick. This is on the free college tuition, because it sort of plays into the idea that when it comes to health care, that a lot of these people who do not have coverage do not have it, because they're eligible for Medicaid under Obamacare, but the Republican governors are keeping them from getting it.
Right.
On a similar vein here was Hillary Clinton talking about Bernie Sanders' plan for free college tuition for all that would be paid for by a tax on the Wall Street
financial
transaction tax.
You know, I think, again, both of us share the goal of trying to make college affordable for all young Americans. If you don't have some agreement within the system from states and from families and from students, it's hard to get to where we need to go. And Senator Sanders' plan really rests on making sure that governors like Scott Walker contribute $23 billion on the first day to make college free. I'm a little skeptical about your governor actually caring enough about higher education to make any kind of commitment like that.
Very quickly, before we go to a break, David, about 30 seconds here. Explain to me, why would that free college tuition plan rely on people like Republican Governor Scott Walker?
That's where Sanders gets some of the money from in his plan, is to sort of plus up the contribution, traditional contribution, that states give to higher ed. Walker just last year took $450 million out of higher ed in the state of Wisconsin.
So it doesn't all
come. It's a legitimate thing for Hillary Clinton to say, is that what is your governor going to contribute to this program? There are two answers to that. Number one is, well, maybe the money has to be, you know, found in the federal budget, number one. Or number two, it is not a static situation that there will be Republican governors all over the country that are undermining a duly elected president. We actually can change who the governor is in these states. And so, you know, it seems like Hillary keeps searching for the impracticalities where you could actually envision ways where those dissolve away.
Her new slogan may be "No, we can't" on some of these issues.
It's not possible.
I gotta take a break. I've got a question. We'll get to the one place where I think the Thursday night debate may have really made a difference for Hillary Clinton, and one message that she may have pulled out that could really be effective as this campaign moves forward. So stand by, everyone. We only have a few more minutes left, but as Wolf Blitzer would say, we're just getting started. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast.
But here's the point I want to make tonight. I am not a single issue candidate, and I do not believe we live in a single issue country.
He's a one trick pony. One trick is all that horse can do. He does one trick only. It's the principal source of his revenue.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Last few minutes of our coverage of the Thursday night Democratic debate up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, with journalists David Dayan and Jackie Schechner and Desi Doyen here with me. Okay, Jackie, that seems to me, fair or not, that what you heard Hillary just saying here, they're calling Bernie Sanders, his campaign, a single issue candidacy, and we don't live in a single issue country. It seems to me that while that it is incredibly unfair, and that, you know, all of the things that Bernie Sanders is calling for he is wrapping them up into a coherent message. It is not a single issue, but it is a coherent message, and she seems like she's is left with nothing but an attack against him as if he does have a single issue candidacy. So I think that's an effective retort to his to Bernie's coherent theme from his candidacy. What are your thoughts on that, and will we hear more of that going forward?
I think she's going to test that out again. You're right, though. It's not a single issue. He's bringing it back to the economic argument because it taps into everything. It really does touch a lot of the problems that we have in this country, mm-hmm. and so he is putting a bow around it, and it's a neat message, and it's an easy one for people to understand because it's hitting them on the kitchen table issues. I think the biggest problem Clinton has right now is that nobody doubts that she's qualified to be president. I really believe that. Like, she is infinitely qualified. She would be a fine president. I think everybody knows that. But she's not inspiring people. She's not getting people excited the way she should as the potential to be the first female president. And I don't know if it's because we're tired. I don't know if it's because the Clintons had been around for a long time. I don't know if it's because the Republicans have done a good job of attempting to smear her with the email server, Benghazi, the same stuff we've heard over and over again. I don't know why it is, but she's not exciting people the way that Sanders is, and so she's going to try to do what she can to poke holes in what he has. And I think that this is a strategy we're going to see, and we'll see how it plays out, because I think last night was the first time she attempted it, and a lot of the pundits are saying, ooh, that's a good one.
Well, Dave,
I just don't know if it's going to resonate.
David, taking on Wall Street campaign and the campaign finance system and the tax structure and providing health care for all and free college tuition for all, that's hardly one
that's
issue.
Not a single issue.
No, it's not a single issue, but... It seems, though, it's kind of Republicanish to do this, to go after his strength. I mean, because that's really a strength of his. If they have textbooks down the line about how to, messaging for candidates, Bernie Sanders should be on the cover. She's taking on his strength with that, and it may be dirty, but it seems like it's really smart politics for her, doesn't it, David?
Yeah, I mean, I thought her closing statement was pretty solid, and the thing that resonated for me is that there's a lot of talk here that this is, a big contested primary where everyone slugs it out is bad for the Democratic Party. And I think when you see where Hillary Clinton has come from to where she got in that ending speech, which was actually kind of inspiring when she was talking about women's rights and LGBT rights and immigrants' rights and all those things, I think it's been an undeniable net positive for her to have to go through this, to really dig into the message of the Democratic Party, because this is ultimately, Sanders is kind of a vessel for an argument that the party is having with itself over how to position themselves for the future in terms of being a populist party or being a party that is beholden to its special interests in some manner. And for her to have to go through that, I think ultimately she's going to come out on the other side a much better candidate if she advances at all.
And we've got just 30 seconds and or about a minute or so, and since I'm playing Wolf Blitzer here, predictions. Anybody want to make a prediction about Nevada or South Carolina? I'm not going to put anyone on the spot because I think predictions are so stupid. But I would like to welcome all three of you to be as stupid as you like. Jackie, let's start with you.
No, I don't want to make any predictions, but I have to say that I think it's really important that we continue to keep a close eye on Trump. And I only say that because the rhetoric is getting more and more heated. I think it's becoming more and more it's more and more of a possibility that he's going to be their nominee, and it scares me, to be honest. So I think that we need to keep track of what he's doing and saying, and we need to figure out a way that we're going to fight against that if he does become the nominee, because I don't know that the normal political arguments will work, and we can't just assume that whoever our candidate is will be able to take him down easily, because I don't think any of the rules apply when it comes to how he's playing this game and how he's running this campaign.
David Dayen, any stupid predictions or final thoughts?
I don't know what's going to happen in Nevada. I was out there 8 years ago. Those caucuses are wild.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being in a casino ballroom watching the caucus, and all the workers from the casino in full uniform, where it was like a Halloween party. That was what the caucus looks like.
Mm-hmm.
It's a state where on the Democratic side, the culinary union has a major role of what to say. It's almost a machine state in that sense. A significant amount of the electorate comes from there, and so that's going to be a major contributing factor. And then we'll see what the diversity of the electorate looks like.
Desi Doyen, dumb predictions or closing thoughts?
No dumb prediction here, but a closing thought about Trump to speak to what Jackie said. I think part of this is, where is the corporate media that made fun of Al Gore and made fun of Howard Dean and made fun and participated in the swift voting of John Kerry? They're not here to do the same treatment to Trump. So it's interesting how they haven't participated like they have in the past in torpedoing the campaigns of Democrats.
Kerry didn't get them good ratings.
As Wolf Blitzer would say, we've got to leave it right there. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, and of course to my guests today, David Dayen and Jackie Schechner. Follow David on the Twitters at DDayen. Follow Jackie on the Twitters at Jackie Schechner. All right, that's it for today. We will be back with you next time. Oh, I think we'll be back with our GOP debate coverage on our next thrilling episode. Until then, if you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can download them all for free at bradblog.com or over at iTunes, where I hope you'll give us a good review. And you can find and follow me on the Twitters at TheBradBlog or send me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. That's it for now. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.